Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I was asked to speak to you this evening on the topic, is atheism is irrational? It may surprise you to know that I think that the answer to that question is no, it is not irrational. However, it's also a deceptively complicated title, and frankly, just a little ambiguous. And I'm in philosophy, so we love ambiguity and sorting out ambiguities. Ambiguous and deceptive because it seems so clear to us, it seems unclear to us what it's asking. It seems so clear to us what it's asking, but it isn't clear. So I'll begin by clarifying the title a bit and then argue that atheism is not irrational, indeed that it is, on the contrary, rational. Let's begin by asking what it is to be irrational and what atheism is, and then what is a believing, practicing Catholic like me to do about it. Aquinas, whom I study, following Aristotle, holds that no position is so false that there's no element of truth to be found within it. Well, if that philosophical and theological commitment to considering the views of those with whom one disagrees extends even to atheism, then we should be able to find some truth in atheism. But if there is truth in atheism, it cannot be irrational. And that's a nice little argument if you think about it. Hopefully this works, yes. Premise one, an intellectual position in order to be wholly or partially true cannot be irrational. But there is truth in the intellectual position of atheism. Conclusion, therefore atheism cannot be irrational. Notice what I've done there. Philosophers will say that in the first premise, I have said that truth is a sufficient condition for not being irrational, and that not being irrational is a necessary condition for truth. I actually think that being false is also a sufficient condition for not being irrational. But I doubt that I will have the time here to explain that assertion. In any case, what I have not claimed is that not being irrational, or better, that being rational, is a sufficient condition for truth. To put it otherwise, you cannot turn around and say that because some intellectual position is rational, it is true. In particular, you cannot say that because atheism is rational, it's true. That just doesn't follow. So the first thing I want you to take from this talk is that Professor John O'Callaghan of the University of Notre Dame did not claim that atheism is true, because it's rational. If I were more famous and were to make such a claim, it would likely make a big headline for the New York Times, which will always publish something by someone from Notre Dame asserting something that seems to contradict church teaching. Oddly, the Times doesn't seem to be too interested in or eager to publish things by those of us at Notre Dame who agree with church teaching. Not newsworthy, I guess, but that's another topic. What Professor O'Callaghan claimed is that there's an element of truth in atheism, and therefore it is not irrational. And I will go so far as to say that a certain form of atheism is very rational, but rationality is no guarantee of truth, while truth is a guarantee of rationality. One unfortunate aspect of our culture is that when we find ourselves in a disagreement with others, we often adopt the view that persistent disagreement with us must be due either to the moral corruption of our adversary or to his or her irrationality. Because many of us mostly shy away from moral condemnation of others as somehow itself morally wrong, we default into what we think is a morally better position, denying the very rationality of our opponent. I am right, so he's not just wrong. Worse, he's irrational for disagreeing with me. There's actually a philosophical history to that tendency coming out of the Renaissance and Enlightenment, in which René Descartes and Immanuel Kant play a large part, among others. On the other hand, a much older tradition of thought sees the root of disagreement typically in the difficulty of the subject matter, not in the irrationality of one or another of the parties disputing. Just consider Thomas Aquinas' point in this passage, and this is from the very beginning of his great work on called the Summa Theologiae. It was necessary for human beings to be instructed by divine revelation, even with respect to those things about God that can be discovered by human reason. For the truth about God that is discovered by reason would come to human beings only for a few, and after a long time, and mixed in with many errors. But the whole of human salvation, which lies in God, depends on the cognition of this truth. Therefore, in order that salvation should come to human beings more suitably and more surely, it was necessary for them to be instructed in divine things through divine revelation. The first thing to notice is that Aquinas thinks philosophical discourse can arrive at some rational and true conclusions concerning the existence and character of God. But the very reason for divine revelation of the existence of God and divine providence is because of the difficulty of knowing these truths simply by using one's reason apart from revelation. Most of what is revealed by God in faith cannot be known apart from God's revelation. But Aquinas thinks some things can be, like the existence of God, that God is providential, and that he should be worshipped. Can be known, but can, you'll remember from your childhood, is not the same as may or is. In fact, Aquinas suggests these truths about God are very hard to know apart from revelation. Only a very few people would know them that way. To know these truths would likely take those few most of a lifetime, and they would likely make lots of errors about them if God left them to themselves to figure them out. For someone like Aquinas, and I think we can take him as a paradigmatic figure, for someone like Aquinas, how could atheism be irrational if, on the contrary, he admits, indeed argues, that without revelation, almost no one employing her own reason would be able to know without lots of errors the existence and providence of God? Indeed, if Aquinas is right about that, isn't atheism on its face, actually a fairly reasonable position for those who lack faith? The atheist at least has such a passion for the truth that she wants to avoid error, and that passion for truth is certainly rational. It is the same passion for the truth that drives the rationality of faith to know the existence of God, to love God, and to worship God, all by God's merciful gift of revelation. As Joseph Ratzinger, later Benedict XVI, asserted in his work Introduction to Christianity at the very beginning, the believer and the atheist come together in a kind of communion of desire for the truth when they both ask themselves, but what if I'm wrong? To look more closely at the rationality of atheism, we have to try to figure out what atheism is. Atheism can mean many things. If you tell me that God is a big white man with a big white beard sitting on a big white cloud, well, then call the New York Times, because they'll want to run a story of the Irish Catholic Thomist, atheist, from Notre Dame, speaking at Michigan State University, sponsored by the Thomistic Institute, founded by Dominican priests, because hell if I'm not an atheist, if that's what you tell me what God is like. But belief in such a God is childish theism. When I was a child, I played with childish things. But this childishness should not or should be put away with your stuffed animals and tinker toys. And you should be a big white man atheist. Socrates, on the other hand, was accused of not believing in the gods of Athens. We could call Socrates' atheism Athenian atheism. Now, again, if that is what atheism is, then I'm an atheist, along with Socrates. For with Socrates, I do not believe in the gods of Athens. And since I hope you will agree I am eminently rational, why, after all, did you ask me here and sit here for an hour to listening to me? It follows immediately that atheism of this sort, Athenian atheism, is rational. Now, consider the interesting fact of history that in the classical Roman world, in the early church, Christians were considered atheists, while Jews were not. Jews were allowed to practice their faith, worshiping their God amidst the Romans, who of course worshiped their own gods. Jewish worship, even though it rejected the gods of Rome, was thus not seen as a challenge to Roman pantheism. Of course, Christians always claimed that they worshiped the same God as the Jews. I don't know for sure, but I suspect the accusation against the Christians, but not the Jews, had to do with the political situation of the Jews being subject to the Romans. And yet the Christians being understood with their worship of God to be departing from the Jewish worship that was politically subjugated by Rome to its pantheon. Roman atheism had a large dose of the political in it, as did Athenian atheism before it. These Roman gods were city gods, gods of the empire. They did not transcend the politics of the city and the empire. If the city ruled another city, the gods of that other city could be included in the imminent frame of divine worship because subject to the Senate and people of Rome. If you've ever been to Rome, SQPR, Senate and People of Rome. But to stress the mystery of the incarnation, by which God and Jesus Christ became immanent in the world, the Christians emphasize that aspect of the Jewish God that is his transcendence of the city and its politics, indeed his transcendence of the entire universe. My kingdom is not of this world. So the Christians were considered atheists by the Romans because, again, they did not worship the gods of Rome. And here again, I am a Roman atheist, and I suspect all of you are as well. Indeed, broadly, you could call me a political atheist. I refuse to worship the gods of any city, nation, or empire, whoever or whatever they may be. Thus, I am an atheist in at least three different ways. So you shouldn't be surprised that I think atheism is rational. I am an atheist in at least three different ways. A big white man atheist, a Socratic atheist, and a political atheist. So is there any hope for me and those like me, Roman Catholic Thomists, of avoiding atheism? Atheism seems, from so many angles, not simply to be rational, but eminently true. My point in bringing up these examples is that the meaning of atheism is contextual. Presumably, what is of concern to us here is contemporary atheism, the ordinary run-of-the-mill godless atheism of Manhattan, Washington, D.C., even East Lansing. Presumably, your godless Manhattanite or Washingtonian does not have it in mind to deny the Athenian gods like Socrates, or the Roman gods like the early Christians. Perhaps he or she is a political theist, worshiping the gods of contemporary Manhattan and D.C. But the godless Manhattanites, Washingtonians, and East Lansingtonians, I'm interested in, have it in mind to deny that the God Christians claim to worship exists. That's not because he believes in the Athenian or Roman gods instead of the Christian God, as the Emperor Justinian did. When this godless Manhattanite or East Lansingtonian toasts the death of God, he does not toast Zeus and his death. He toasts the death of Jesus Christ, and not simply as a historical event. Nietzsche, great 19th century philosopher, Nietzsche claimed in his time that the triumph of Christ in Western culture is total and is most manifest in the death of the Roman gods at the hands of the Jewish God incarnate in Jesus Christ. In The Genealogy of Morals, one of his great works, he points out that the triumph of Jewish values over aristocratic Greek and Roman values is signaled by the fact that in Rome today, one bows down to three Jews and a Jewess: the fisherman Peter, the carpet maker Paul, Jesus of Nazareth, and Jesus' mother. But he could just as well have pointed out that the triumph of Christ as God is signaled by the fact that atheism no longer means denying the gods of the city, but denying the existence of the God who spoke to Moses, and denying that Christ is that God incarnate. The symbol of Christ's utter conquest of the Pantheon is in fact the ancient building called the Pantheon, still standing in Rome today, but which is now a basilica of the Roman Catholic Church, with its own bishop and the Eucharist, Jesus Christ, fully present, body, soul, and divinity, reserved in the sanctuary of the tabernacle in the Pantheon. On Pentecost Sunday, in an extraordinarily beautiful ceremony, Mass ends with a shower of rose petals pouring in through the oculus, which is the opening in the dome, in the ceiling of the building. Petals that symbolize the flames of the Holy Spirit showering down upon the apostles. So if you are ever in Rome on Pentecost, don't go to St. Peter's Square. Go to that. They let the parishioners of the basilica in first, and then you have to sit and you have to stand through the Mass. But it really is gorgeous, and I've been there for it twice. Sorry for the digression, and the first time I went there, there was a seagull trapped inside the Pantheon because it had flown in through the oculus. It's a seagull, not a dove, but of course it's white. And when those rose petals started coming in through the oculus, the seagull had been trying to get out, but of course it couldn't, because to really get out of the oculus, at one point it would spiral up, and then it would try to go vertical, and it couldn't go vertical to go out, right? It would just almost get there and then have to go down. But then when the rose petals started coming down, the seagull started just flying around the column of rose petals. I mean, just absolutely marvelous. So my one recommendation for Rome, for any of you who go there. So the God of the Jews has thoroughly routed the Athenian and Roman gods, so much so that there is no point to being an Athenian or Roman atheist. Perhaps here is where you might get a taste of the irrationality of some sorts of atheism, although it is almost too fanciful to imagine. Imagine someone on the street claiming to be an atheist, and claiming that his atheism was the centerpiece of his intellectual life, like many contemporary atheists claim about themselves. The people who for a while wanted to insist that we call them brights. Just as an aside, I'm amused at the fact that the culture never really picked up on that effort to self-name themselves as bright. Maybe not such a bright idea after all. Call me bright. Call me bright. Call me bright. Why would that ever take off? But then it came out in your conversation with this bright that what he means is that the centerpiece of his life is that he does not believe in the gods of Athens. I mean, as I've said, I don't believe in the gods of Athens. But for goodness sake, I don't make it the centerpiece of my intellectual life and demand that you call me bright for doing so. So frankly, it would be rational for you to think you had met a man who had lost his marbles, a man whose life in Manhattan or East Lansing at least in what he himself identifies as the centerpiece of his life, is in large measure irrational. Coming from Greenway, Wisconsin, and Notre Dame, as I do, I'm pretty well disposed toward thinking that people who live in Manhattan or East Lansing are irrational. We know for a fact that they are in Washington, D.C. So if I met an Athenian atheist on the street outside, I'd take it that the case for his irrationality was definitive. But I am much more likely to meet a rational, godless atheist East Lansingtonian of a different sort, right, outside the university library, than an irrational Athenian atheist, or at least I hope so. So the irrational atheism aside, as far as I can see, the more rational atheists of contemporary Manhattan, Washington, and East Lansing, and the contemporary world, deny the existence of the God of the Jews incarnate in Jesus Christ. The God who banished, indeed destroyed the rationality of worshiping the gods of the pagans, but also, by that banishment, banished the Athenian atheism of the likes of Socrates. When it comes to God and atheism, there's really only one game in town, and you either play it or sit on the sidelines. It's Notre Dame versus Michigan State, the leprechaun versus Sparty. Why would you want to deny Zeus, Mars, or Apollo when you can deny God incarnate in Jesus Christ? They are boring. He is exciting. Athenian atheism in this day and age is banal and borders upon the irrational. Atheism denying the God of Abraham. Now that's something grand, even in this day and age. But then why is atheism rational? As far as I can see, there are really two and maybe three reasons for the rationality of contemporary atheism, of the sort I think is worth discussing. I think the first two can be grouped under the heading Nobo Daddy, mentioned in Blake's poem, To Nobo Daddy. Why art thou silent and invisible, father of jealousy? Why dost thou hide thyself in clouds from every searching eye? Why darkness and obscurity in all thy words and laws, that none dare eat the fruit but from the wily serpent jaws? Or is it because secrecy gains females loud applause? The first of those two reasons has to do with thinking about God in relation to the natural world and its study in natural science, and I'm very glad we're in a building of natural science. The second is the problem of evil. The third is related to the second and what I like to call the problem of Christians. Nobo Daddy is a figure of scorn in Blake's poetry. He's an anthropomorphic projection from a human being of limited power to a god of infinite power. Essentially, the god Nobo Daddy is just like a human being, only capable of achieving whatever he sets out to achieve because of his power. The name is a portmanteau formed from nobody and daddy, as in nobody's daddy, to mark a contrast with the conception of God as everybody's daddy. Our daddy. If God is everybody's daddy, why is he so silent in the face of the needs of his children, as Blake's poem asks? Well, because he is in reality nobody's daddy. He is Nobo Daddy. The truth in contemporary atheism and its rationality is to deny the existence of Nobo Daddy. So I'll read that again. The truth in contemporary atheism and its rationality is to deny the existence of Nobo Daddy. How is Nobo Daddy manifest in thinking about God in relation to the world and the understanding that is achieved in natural science? Well, Nobo Daddy is captured very well by Richard Dawkins. If you don't understand how something works, never mind. Just give up and say God did it. You don't know how the nerve impulse works? Good. You don't understand how memories are laid down in the brain? Excellent. Is photosynthesis a bafflingly complex process? Wonderful. Please don't go to work on the problem. Just give up and appeal to God. The conception of God that one sees there is of an intervening God, posited to account for the gaps in our understanding of the natural world. According to Dawkins, if theists, that is, people who believe in the existence of God, don't have a scientific explanation of something, we say that God caused it. Our confidence in the existence of God is supposed to be based upon the failure to understand the world in scientific terms. Notice here the tacit association of religious belief with scientific ignorance, even perhaps irrationality. This is the so-called God of the gaps argument. Think of the ways in which the Greek and Roman pantheons the gods were portrayed as constantly messing around with human lives by unpredictable interventions in the course of necessity or fate. Those gods were very much like human beings, only projected as more powerful than human beings and not subject to death. Well, here, with Nobodaddy as an alternative to scientific explanation, there's a hint of this ancient paganism in some corners of contemporary religious belief. Only here, the gods have been purified of their human, all too human foibles, like envy, pride, and lust. We now think there is only one such God, and we think the one God doesn't just have greater powers than we have, but infinite power. But still, like the pagans, we are to attribute to the workings of that one omnipotent God the mysterious things that take place in nature that we haven't figured out according to the best science. In the vision of Dawkins and other such scientifically minded atheists, the God Christians worship hasn't truly broken free from the pagan pantheon, but remains conceived of in immanent and pagan terms. Christianity is just another paganism. Where the Greeks and Romans were polytheists, thinking there are many gods, many such gods, we Christians are thought to be monotheists, thinking there's only one such God. But the conception of divinity appears to remain the same. Pagan divinity that messes around with the world and us, accounting for what we cannot understand in the world and in our lives specifically. We should acknowledge that there are Christians who give weight and thus rationality to the accusation of the contemporary atheists that the God Christians believe in is just such a God of the gaps, just another pagan God after Christ. There's a complicated history to this problem that some would see exemplified in the watchmaker God posited by Paley as an argument for the existence of God. Nature is like a great watch. Science may be able to explain the material out of which the watch is made, but what it cannot explain is the grand complexity of the watch, because science refuses to appeal to intelligence in the workings of nature. How could such complexity not be the expression of intelligence? The Christian asks. Ironically, Paley's argument can be understood as an updating of an argument offered by the ancient Roman Cicero. An updated version of this pagan argument that goes back at least to Cicero is also found in the contemporary intelligent design movement among some Christians. It's claimed that there are just some irreducible complexities in nature that only intelligence can explain. Science, however, only appeals to blind, unintelligent forces. So again, in the absence of an explanation in the gaps of scientific theory, we find room for an intelligent designer, a pagan god who plays with the blind natural forces of fate and necessity. Indeed, the advocates of such intelligent design even sometimes claim the mantle of scientific theory for themselves, positioning it as just another possible scientific explanation that would be falsified if natural science did eventually explain the phenomenon and thus close the gap. This is Nobodaddy as designer. And atheists are not just rational in denying the existence of Nobodaddy, they are, in my view, right to do so. I've stressed that the idea of Nobodaddy as alternative to scientific explanation is a survival of a pagan conception of divinity now applied to the God that Christians worship. The most obvious problem of this quasi-Christian, quasi-pagan God of the gaps is that as the gaps in scientific understanding of the world shrink, so also does the God of the gaps. And as you fill them in, the gap gets smaller and smaller, and the place for God gets smaller and smaller until, poof, no more God of the gaps. Shrinks to the point where one has to admit the possibility that if the gaps are ever entirely closed, the God of the gaps will be locked out of existence, so to speak. So ironically, when Christians defend this pagan God of the gaps, they provide the atheists they oppose with perhaps the best support for the rationality of their atheism. Indeed, its truth. For both atheist and Christian of this sort, God is Nobo Daddy. But the Christians themselves provide the milk and honey of the rationality of such atheism. However, the contemporary atheist is wrong to think that the features of Nobo Daddy are the features of God, whom Christians genuinely believe in, despite the fact that some Christians do seem to believe in Nobo Daddy. Notice first that in the pagan pantheon, the gods do not become human. They may appear in the guise of a human, but they do not become truly human. They cannot die as human beings do. But the claim about Christ is that he is truly divine and truly human. He becomes truly human without ceasing to be truly divine. God truly dies according to the humanity of Jesus Christ. We cannot expect an atheist to understand that claim. But the atheist is not irrational for not understanding it, since we who are Christians are not irrational. But we also claim we cannot understand it. We assert it to be truth, but we do not claim to understand it. By faith, we know it is true. Consider an analogy. By natural faith in my mother, I claim a certain man as my father, and I am rational to do so. But I do not understand why he is my father beyond the simple facts of the birds and the bees. Why him and not another, for example? She understands that. But to what extent do I understand it, even if she describes it for me? I can know something to be true by faith and be rational in believing it without fully or truly understanding it, and with the hope that one day I will understand it. The death of God, according to the humanity of Jesus Christ, remains a mystery for us to ponder, not a problem for us to understand and solve, but also with the hope that one day we will understand it. We understand, however, that it is a mystery precisely because the conception of God we are operating with transcends the frame of immanence characteristic of ancient paganism. A pagan God appearing to be human could appear to die, but could not really die. Our claim is that the God we worship did, in fact, die. His immortal frame put on our mortality so that in our turn, our mortal frame might put on his immortality. This is, as St. Paul says, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. I don't mention it as a way of solving the problem of Nobo Daddy, but simply to remind ourselves that we do not worship an anthropomorphic projection of perfect humanity when we say that God became incarnate in Jesus Christ. But if we give the appearance of doing so by arguing for Nobo Daddy on the basis of the failure of science, isn't it rational for someone else who rejects Nobo Daddy to be an atheist in the contemporary context? And if it is rational for we who have Christian faith to be Nobo Daddy atheists, to deny the existence of Nobo Daddy, isn't it also rational for those who lack Christian faith? Second, and perhaps more important, at the heart of Orthodox Christian doctrine concerning God's relationship to the world is the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, the doctrine that God created the world from nothing. Another way to put that doctrine is that the sole cause of creation, all that exists other than God, the sole cause of that is God. The watchmaker and the intelligent designer do not create from nothing. They work with material that is presupposed to their making. The watchmaker makes a watch, but he makes it from metal. The intelligent designer designs something from the stuff that the scientist has explained. And in the back and forth of the God of the Gaps versus science argument, that stuff explained by the scientist was not designed by God in that dialectic. It was presupposed to the God of the Gaps. If the reason for thinking God exists is that it is an alternative explanation to science when it fails, then when science succeeds, God is banished from the arena of its success. In this picture, Nobo Daddy competes with other causes to create something. The more Nobo Daddy does, the less those other causes do. And the more that those other causes do, the less Nobo Daddy does. However, a God who creates from nothing all things that exist other than himself does not compete with those things that he creates. He enables them. God is the great enabler. Scientific explanation does not succeed despite God, but because of God. It is because God has created the world to be understandable by us that we are able to understand it through scientific explanation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And through the Word, all things came to be, and nothing came to be without him. I think I might skip these quotations from Pope Clement, St. Augustine, and then Gerard Manley Hopkins' great poem, God's Grandeur, just for time. But the point of the three quotations is three major figures, Pope Clement, Augustine in the early church, and Gerard Manley Hopkins in the 19th, praising the intelligibility of the world as the way that God speaks to us. Science isn't the only way, but science is a way in which God is speaking to us, not an alternative to what God says. When these Christians write so eloquently of discerning God in creation, they do not discern God in what they do not understand about the world. That's not where they discern God, in what they don't understand. They discern him, rather, in what they understand, the beauty of the world that works as it does. God isn't silent in the world like Nobo Daddy. He speaks to us through the intelligibility of creation as the Word, or the original Greek of John's Gospel, the Logos, which is much broader than the English term Word, meaning intelligibility, reason, understanding, Logos. As the Word or Logos by whom all things were made. For these Christians, the best argument for the existence of God, apart from faith, is that science succeeds in understanding the world, not that it fails to do so. Again, Richard Dawkins writes, "There is real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality." There is real truth in what Dawkins says there, although I would suggest science is only one form of the poetry of reality. And certainly, St. Augustine would say to Dawkins, "You are not irrational. What you say is true. However, while you recite the poetry, I come to speak of you of the poet." The bottom line on Nobo Daddy atheism associated with those atheists who point to the glories of science in competition with the designer God, the great handbag designer in the sky, is that such atheism is not irrational, and it is even in part true. If one is to criticize it, it isn't because it's irrational, but that it is often ignorant of what Orthodox historic Christianity believes in God, or belief in God actually consists in. But to engage these atheists, those of us who call ourselves Christians, have to first make clear that we too are Nobo Daddy atheists when it comes to the glories of scientific understanding. We also need to make clear that what we believe in is the God of the Gospel of John, through whom all things were made, and who enabled and gave to us the world so well understood by the glories of science. But what of the Nobo Daddy of the problem of evil? The atheism prompted by the problem of evil is not similarly driven by ignorance, and in that respect may be even more rational than that driven by the glories of science. A straightforward way of putting the problem of evil is the following, and many of you may have seen this in a philosophy class. Premise one, Christians believe that God is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent. Premise two, an omniscient being would have the knowledge of evil and the knowledge of how to prevent it or eliminate it, would have the power to prevent or eliminate it, and from its omnibenevolence, act morally to prevent or eliminate it. Conclusion, therefore, if God exists, there should be no evil. But there is evil. Therefore, God does not exist. This argument is not driven by ignorance, since Christians do believe what it claims we believe, and evil does exist. I do, however, still suspect that there's a touch of the pagan anthropomorphic human projection in it that I mentioned in talking about Nobo Daddy, particularly in the second premise about what omnibenevolence would do. What we mean by omniscience, omnipotence, and omnibenevolence seems to turn out again to be a projection of perfection of our own knowledge, power, and particularly our own moral goodness. God would do what I would do if I were God. That is, if I were smarter, more powerful, and a better man than I am. That apparent projection is why I continue to class it under Nobo Daddy. Indeed, Blake seems to have had this Nobo Daddy more in mind when he mentions the silence of Nobo Daddy amidst the suffering of his supposed children. Still, one would have to be exceedingly morally obtuse to chalk this argument up to ignorance or to deny the rationality of it. Consider the ballad Dear God by the rock group XTC. Just a passage from it. Dear God, I'd sing it if I could sing it, but it's a marvelous song. Look it up on YouTube. Dear God, hope you got the letter, and I pray you can make it better down here. I don't mean a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet because they don't get enough to eat from God. I can't believe in you. Contemporary atheism driven by the problem of evil is driven by a real appreciation of, and often but not always, a real horror at the reality of evil. And it would do no good for Christians to deny the horror of that reality to save God from this rational atheism, rather than be saved by God. I added not always, and this is after many years of long experience of this, I added not always because in academic philosophical context within which I live, context, seminar rooms, and lecture halls, the problem of evil is not infrequently put forward by atheists who themselves don't seem to be doing much about the suffering they know about and have the power to alleviate. They begin the problem with the projection of their own knowledge, power, and moral goodness into perfection, and yet with respect to that starving, naked, ill person downtown, even with their actual limited knowledge, power, and moral goodness, they often aren't doing anything about it, however limited and imperfect their efforts would be if they tried. Rather, they expect someone else to do it. A god, perhaps. Perhaps the city god or the national god. It's as if they expect God to do what they themselves could, but don't in fact do. Indeed, it seems that they just don't want to believe in God, and the suffering of others is merely the occasion for justifying their unbelief, not an occasion to act on behalf of those who suffer. Still, there are many sincere atheists genuinely horrified by suffering, who cannot believe in a God who allows it. And we should accept not just the rationality of their atheism, but also its sincerity and, frankly, its attraction. I'd call this sincere atheism, driven by the reality of evil and human suffering, good faith atheism, not just rational atheism. As you may know, there is a philosophical response to the problem of evil from within classical Christianity called the free will defense. That defense consists in suggesting that it isn't obvious that a good being must act to eliminate evil when he knows about it and can so act, since that might eliminate free will. The idea is that perhaps the reason why God allows for and tolerates evil is because of the great good of human freedom in the world. While this is part of the Christian tradition, I cannot help but find it unsatisfying, and again, kind of banal. First, because the two figures of the Christian tradition I study the most, St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, while mentioning it, don't really put much weight on it. Augustine himself, later in his work, even criticizes that response. Second, I worry that other Christians go beyond speculating that free will may be the reason that God allows evil and suffering into suggesting that that is the reason why God allows it, as if we knew the mind of God. I will not deny the rationality of the atheist who does not think that his free will excuses the Holocaust, or the death of a man sleeping alone on the streets of East Lansing in midwinter, or the slaughter of innocent children studying in school. The problem for Christians in offering the free will defense is their own failure to pay attention to God himself in the revelation they claim to believe. Job asks God why all this crap is happening to him. However, notice that God does not offer the free will defense in his own defense. God doesn't defend himself at all. What he does is put Job in his place. Who do you think you are? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who set its measurements, since you know. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. If this were the response of one man however omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent to another man, we would say that the first man just told the second man to go to hell, or worse. Christians should believe Job is a warning to all those who believe in God, a warning against trying to understand the reasons of God as if he were just another Superman, the biggest guy on the block, the biggest, wisest, bestest guy on the block. And yet, instead of pondering Job, we Christians are tempted to put all our chips behind the free will defense. God is in the dock, as C.S. Lewis said in a very famous essay, and we are God's attorneys. We will save God. However, at the real heart of Christianity, the response of God to evil is not just what God says to Job. Genuine Christian belief is that the ultimate and final response of God to evil and suffering is the birth of mercy from the womb of Mary. Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, Hail Queen, Mother of Mercy. God does not tell us his reasons for allowing evil. If he did, would we understand them? Wisdom begins in recognizing that we do not know. Socrates said that, the pagan. What God does tell us is how he responds to evil. It used to be that anybody who watched an American football game on TV knew John 3:16. I say used to be, since it seems the NFL, in its monopolistic branding of all things, has banned the banners people would hang from the railing, including the ones that always said John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him might not perish, but might have eternal life. Thomas Aquinas teaches us that mercy of any sort springs from friendship. There is no genuine mercy from a distance in the absence of genuine friendship. And he goes on to teach us that God's mercy is the expression of divine friendship, even in our creation, and certainly in our redemption. I don't want to be so bold as to claim to know the reason why God allows evil. I fear that if I do, God will tell me to go to hell, or worse. But I do know what God's response to evil is. Merciful friendship for all human beings that begins by suffering with those who suffer evil and then acts to alleviate it. I think the problem with the free will defense, besides the moral obtuseness with which it is often put forward by righteous Christians, is that it causes us to forget what we know about God's response to evil, not his defense. It causes us to forget the face of mercy born of Mary looking at them from within her lap. God gives friendship and mercy as a response to evil. We give the free will defense. Whom should we listen to? Those without faith will say that they do not understand this. But again, we cannot accuse them of irrationality for failing to understand it, unless we are willing to accuse ourselves of irrationality for not understanding it either. There are truths that everyone knows that they may not understand. How can light be both a particle and a wave? We know this. But what do we mean if we claim to understand it? We know that mercy is a person and died for all of us, even if we do not understand it. We call God our Father, but we are not praying to everybody's daddy. Nor, when we believe what John 3:16 says, are we affirming our belief in Nobo Daddy. But this brings me to the third, possibly most important explanation of the rationality of atheism, and it has nothing to do with Nobo Daddy. It is what I call the problem of Christians. Those of us who are Christians know that we are made to the image and likeness of God. And we know what this means. It means we are called to a life of friendship with God and with one another in God, a communion of beatitude with all those whom God loves. But whom does God love? What does this mean in our world? Well, again, we have a teacher. Christ taught us that to be made to his image and likeness is to be merciful. And his face is the face of mercy incarnate. We are to look like him. What does that look like? Well, we know. It looks like friendship that out of love approaches those who suffer and suffers with them, then acts to alleviate that suffering to the extent possible. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. When contemporary atheists look at contemporary Christians, is this what they see? Friendship and compassion. Perhaps what they see is Christians living lives little different from them and all the rest, worshiping the gods of the city and the nation, even as they claim to only worship the God who banished the gods of the cities of Athens and Rome. Who or what are the gods of Notre Dame? Isn't it obvious? But I ask you, who or what are the gods of Notre Dame? Who or what are the gods of Michigan State? Who or what are the gods of the United States? Perhaps they also see us not truly befriending those who suffer, even if we do good works for them. Yes, they can see our hospitals and schools doing good works. But do they see something genuinely different in those hospitals and schools? Is my university, Notre Dame, my institution, just another University of Michigan that just happens to be staffed mostly by Christians? Or is it something different as a community of friends loving God and loving their neighbors in God? You tell me, and tell me, who is my neighbor? It is well documented that Christianity spread in ancient Rome because the Christians did not leave Rome like everyone else in the hot summer months when deadly diseases spread. They remained with the pagan poor and sick, befriended them, cared for them, and sometimes died with them. In the absence of friendship, good works are not the works of mercy. There is no mercy from a distance. If atheists do not see something different in the lives of Christians living amongst them, except perhaps what they do in relative private on Sunday mornings and before they go to bed, or those good works without friendship that everyone else does, why would it be irrational for them to think there is no truly significant difference between being a Christian and being an atheist? That Christians themselves do not actually believe in God, the God who responds to evil without trying to defend himself. Is this what atheists see when they look at us? The face of mercy springing from friendship? Perhaps from some of us, but all of us? Is this what they see when they look at me? If God is dead for me, why aren't they perfectly rational for rejecting a dead God? This is what Nietzsche understood. The problem of Christians is that very often Christians themselves are practical atheists. When I encounter an atheist along the road, does he see a friend or an enemy? Does he see a friend who is not scared by his atheism, but is rather pained by his lack of understanding? A friend who acts in a way that will help him understand. That's what I, a philosophy professor from the University of Notre Dame, need to ask myself. And if he does not see the face of mercy in me, I must grant that his atheism is pretty much perfectly rational. His is not Nobo Daddy atheism. It's Christian atheism. And I am responsible for its rationality, since all he sees in me is another atheist. There are lots of reasons why people are atheists in our contemporary world. But perhaps the most important is the failure of Christians themselves to live to the image of mercy. That failure is the phenomenon that best explains the rationality of contemporary atheism. So if you want an atheist to have a chance of knowing and loving God, be merciful to him. The rationality of atheism does not reside in the triumph of science. It does not even reside in the philosopher's problem of evil. It resides in the coldness of hearts, the hearts that turn away the atheists with enmity, labeling them as irrational, and so not to be bothered with. If anyone says, "I love God, but hates his brother," he is a liar. For whoever does not love a brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.